I wish you all would have the opportunity to stand up here and be blessed like that. It's quite a wonderful experience. I have to say that it is pretty daunting to be standing up here this morning, because I am not, like everybody that has preceded me, I am not an expert. I have not written any books. I have not studied all this very extensively. But I'm really up here as a fellow pilgrim. And someone who encountered Celtic spirituality and found a home. It's like suddenly something fit in my spirit, something fit in my mind. And I was always kind of drawn to Celtic spirituality, and I remember going to some workshops, and Anne Jekyll has done some workshops at La Casa that I have gone to of her speakers. And a year and a half ago, I went on a Celtic pilgrimage with a small group to Ireland and Scotland and England. And I'll talk a little bit more about one of the stops on the pilgrimage later. But it was when I first read Philip Newell's book on listening to the heartbeat of God that something really connected with my mind. And theology made sense to me in a way. And then I happened to be up at a Casa de Maria in their bookstore, and I thought, oh, there's another book by Philip Newell. I'll buy it. So I got this book, and I read it, and I can't really explain what it did, but it was like something just went from here to here, and I found myself sitting and reading it and weeping, and not because I was feeling sad, but I was, something in me was so moved that it was kind of astonishing, and so wow. And I guess what I'm saying is that I kind of fell in love with Celtic spirituality. So I'm here not as an expert, but as a lover today. One of the things about Celtic spirituality that I happened to read about in Anantara by John Donahue, who we'll be hearing a bit more about today and from, is the fact that Celtic spirituality is non-dual. And he wrote this, the Celtic mind was not burdened by dualism. It did not separate what belongs together. And that also was an aha for me, because last spring we heard from Richard Rohr and from others we heard from about the importance of non-dual thinking. And I found myself thinking, well, you know, that's all well and good, but how do you do it? What does it mean? How does it work in what you believe and what you do? And so suddenly, this made sense, because here was something that I could understand, and it was non-dual. So that was another great thing. Well, the Celtic, among many of their other ways of looking at the world, they talked about thin places and thin times. You've probably all heard those expressions here and in other places. And last week we heard about pilgrimage. We heard about Iona, which is certainly one of those thin places, where the two worlds seem very close together. And then there are also thin times when the veil between the two worlds seems very thin. And it's interesting that we're coming upon one of those times very shortly. And, of course, that is Halloween and All Saints and All Souls. And it's fitting, I think, that we have our Halloween decorations in the back today. I don't think anybody came in costume, though. maybe next year that's something we can do. And certainly on St. Patrick's Day we can all remember that.
Spring to wear green.
And as you probably know, Halloween is a Celtic, something that we have gotten from the Celtic tradition. And it was the Feast of Samhain I'm not sure I pronounced any of these Celtic words correctly, but, and that was one of those in-between holidays that the Celts had and it fell between the autumn equinox and the winter solstice. And it also was what counts the beginning of the year. So it was a very important festival, and it was a time when, again, there was a sense of just this curtain being very thin and of things being very close together. And I think we get some of that same sense from the Mexican Day of the Dead and the whole idea that this is a time to remember, and remember in a very special way those that have passed. And certainly the whole idea of going and having parties and drinking tequila at the graves and all these things. It's part of that same idea and that same tradition. And so there are these thin times, and I think there are some thin times that touch many people. And I think that somehow September 11th, that anniversary this year, did some of you have a sense that that was kind of a thin time for many people, that remembrance and that that seems to be important. So there are these sort of corporate thin times, I think. But then there are also personal ones that we all have, I think, important dates. Certainly the death of a loved one. I don't know if any of you have had the same experience, but I'll be kind of going along through September. And then something starts to sort of shift in me, and I'm not really thinking about my husband's death on September 20th. But something inside of me remembers that. And so when that date comes, you know, there's something that is very important that I need to do to kind of commemorate it and touch it. I think similar things happen to us sometimes when we hear a piece of music. Or we see something that sort of takes us back and the veil sort of lifts for a moment. Any of us that have been present for births, I think that is the time when you really sense this, something very special is happening. And the same thing is true of death. There's a very strong sense that the veil is thin and something important is happening. I'm sure you all, anybody else have anything you want to add of thin times that you have experienced or know about health?
Well, I've spent many years taking care of infants and toddlers, and I would notice that about 3 weeks or so before their birthday, they would get really very different. there would be like some kind of internal thing. And then I began to realize that was so all the way into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
That if, as people's birthdays approach, there's a change, an anticipation, a sense of something.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
We remember in our bodies in a way that we don't maybe remember in our heads. Anything else?
There was a story on television the other day about a couple that died in Iowa. And a couple in Iowa who died together. They were in a car accident. And they had them on monitors. And the son told the story that his father stopped breathing, but he was holding his wife's hand. She was still alive, and the heart monitor was still on with him.
Wow.
That is 72 years.
Now, how do we know when we're in a thin place or a thin time?
I think we feel it in our bones. I just returned from a family reunion in Massachusetts. My sister celebrated her 86th birthday and had a huge family, and it was really amazing to reconnect with all my nieces and nephews and so forth. You know, it's really
mm-hmm.
great.
So we know it in our bones, yeah.
You know, I was just thinking when my first grandson was born,
Speak up.
I felt it when my first grandson was born. When my first grandson was born, my other daughter was there, and it was almost like time just stopped. Mm-hmm. We were one. There's no way to really put it into words other than it just. It was a feeling of oneness with the whole thing, the whole process, and your heart is like connected to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are words, but the feeling was as great as when my daughter was born, or different, because mm-hmm. I was aware, a little more aware.
But what we're saying is really, we know it when we know it. Don't we? We know it. Yeah.
I just wanted to share with my father-in-law, he was approaching this, and normally his appearance was very kind of looking down. You never saw his eyes, you know. And suddenly he absolutely looked in absolute bliss. Eyes, big blue eyes, wide open, and it lasted, I would say, a good half minute. And his head went from looking at something, you know, truly in marvel. And then he turned around and he said, and it was a feeling in Jordan. It was very strange. He said, well, I just saw Jesus. And then later on, he saw his own, deceased wife. And my sister-in-law is not into religion. She goes, well, what was mom saying? And he said, well, she was standing on a bridge. And she was asking me to come over. So we were witnesses what they call a shared death experience. And that's definitely a feeling.
There's a sense of holiness, isn't there?
Yes.
And often a love or something kind of, I think it was John Wesley who said, his heart was strangely warmed. And I think that might be one way of describing this feeling. Of being, and it's a sense of presence. Of presence is something more than we are. Something gets touched inside, and we don't know it with our heads and our conscious minds, but we do know it, as somebody said, we know it in our bones and deep inside ourselves. What? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that being the recipient of prayer, mm-hmm. and the custom of laying on hands, not as we do it symbolically here, but physically mm-hmm. laying hands, there's a an overall feeling of warmth in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think many of us have heard or have experienced that. I know I have. And it's a stillness. It brings a stillness about in you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just physically feel warm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've met people say they actually felt burning. You know, it was an actual burning.
I'm just reading a bit from, because the point of chapter 7 is really talking about presence. And in chapter 7, says, was in the midst of earth's pain that McLeod and Teilhard listened. They heard the hymn that is as ancient as the universe and as new as today's fresh birthings of love. It is the hymn that reminds us of the harmony at the heart of creation, the hymn of cosmic sounds and intimate whisperings. It is the hymn in which one theme is heard in an unending infinity of like voices. It is the song of presence. It is the hymn of self-giving love that sets us free to be part of the healing of the universe. And when I read that, I was reminded of something that I heard long ago that has always stuck with me. And this was, I can't even remember if it was on the radio or on the television. There was a concert by St. Olaf's Choir. And St. Olaf's Choir is quite well known. And they travel around the country, and they were giving a Christmas, I believe it was a Christmas concert. And the director of the choir was introducing the concert, or the next piece. And it was an Alleluia. And he introduced it, and it was an Alleluia that went on for about 5 minutes with nothing but Alleluia. And he introduced it by saying, This is the song that is going on all the time. And sometimes we hook into it. And that has always stayed with me as the sense that there's a presence is always with us. But sometimes we sense it in a very special way. And part of it is that, it's interesting that Gerald May, who is a, I think he's dead now, was a psychiatrist who wrote a great deal about spiritual and was part of a spiritual direction program at Chalem in Washington, D.C. But anyway, he wrote that everybody has about 6 experiences of God each day, but we don't know it. Now, how in the world he knew that, I don't know.
He was wearing a godometer.
But I think what he was saying to us was be alert, pay attention, because these things are a lot more common than you think. And they're not necessarily the big capital B visions. I think often we think those big things, but they're often very small, quiet murmurings. And so it's important to kind of be alert and awake and notice when we hear this song of the universe. And I'm going to talk some more about presence in thin places, and we're going to go to Ireland. And first we will visit a sacred place in Eastern Ireland.
Can we
turn the lights down, please, and we'll get this. This is Ireland in the Middle Ages. This is where Dublin is today. And down here is Glendalough that we're going to be talking about shortly, right here. And then later we're going to be going on a little pilgrimage with John O'Donohue. And we'll be going over here on the west coast of Ireland, right in here. Okay. We've been in Scotland for a bit, so now we're going to be in Ireland. And the first place that we'll go to is Glendalough here. And that was the birthplace of St. Kevin. And we've heard about St. Kevin already a bit. But he was born into a royal family. And of course, royal families in Ireland, there were lots of them. If you were a tribal chief, then you were kind of a king. And your family was a royal family. And there were a lot of tribal chieftains around. So, but anyway, he was born into one of those, I suppose aristocracy would be a good word, in the middle of the 6th century. So he lived through the end of the 6th century. Nobody, these dates are not really hard and fast. And as we heard, he was both a hermit and a mystic. And like most of the mystical and spiritual traditions of Ireland, he was very influenced by the Eastern Church, the Desert Fathers in Egypt. And that particular, people think that there were several reasons that this hit Ireland. Part was the trade routes that went from the Middle East, and they've been traced up into Western Britain and into Ireland, particularly in the tin mines that were down in Cornwall and England. And all of that, of course, was part of the Celtic world. And so their way of looking at was kind of to get away, to get out of the desert. In Egypt, they were escaping the Roman Empire. And what they saw as excesses of the Roman Empire. And they went out and they called their little collection of hermits in the desert. They called them monastic cities, and they weren't really cities. They weren't cities in Ireland either, because Ireland was very rural. But they called them cities to differentiate them from the Roman cities. and to say that they were following the law of God, they were in the kingdom of God and not in the kingdom of Rome. So that's why you heard about Kevin in a monastic city. Well, we'll see the city in a little while, and it wasn't quite that. And he was following again the Desert Fathers, he was quite an ascetic. In other words, he lived very simply, as they all did. But he's very well educated. And he wrote prose and he wrote poetry. And poetry, of course, and writing poetry is also a deep Celtic tradition. And I thought this was really interesting. He wrote his rule for monks in Irish verse. Which I think is kind of funny. Of course, and this, of course, is the way they remember it. And he was apparently very loving and kind, and he had a great affinity for nature, especially animals and birds. And from a very early age, and of course the legends by the time that we have them are quite embroidered, but he was supposedly created miracles at a very early age. And Glendalough was a famous pilgrim site from the beginning of the 6th century, the 7th century, and reached its height in 10th century. And pilgrims came from all over Ireland, from Britain, and even from all over Europe. And also at this time, there were many of the learned people in the monasteries that were in Europe, Western Europe. As the barbarian invaders came in, those people fled, and they fled over into Ireland. And so they brought with them a lot of the scholarship and a lot of the wisdom and the books that from the whole Western civilization. So if you read How the Irish Saved Civilization, how many of you have read that book? It's a good book, especially if you're Irish. But this is where they saved civilization, was in places like this monastery in Glendalough and others. Because they had libraries and they had scholars, and it was really their universities as well. And he started out as a hermit there. But then as other people joined him, the monastery began and it became very large and important. And I think it's interesting that pilgrims kept going to Glendalough, and they still do. It's been continuous. And his feast day is June 3rd, and it was celebrated in Glendalough until the 1860s, when the Catholic Church stopped it because of all the disorderly behavior. So we're going to spend a little bit of time there now, but we will not tolerate any disorderly behavior. Behave yourselves for a few minutes. Okay, next. All right, this is the way that the abbey at Glendalough may have looked. This would not have been Kevin's time. Because in Kevin's time, the buildings were probably all wood with thatched roofs, and they were long gone. So this would have been perhaps the way a 10th century pilgrim would have seen it. And you remember that the Celts loved trees. They didn't quite like the Trinity so much. And they had the three worlds, the outer world, the world of the mind, and then the spiritual world. Well, the same thing you'll see here in this diagram. This is the outer world. Here is the sort of the second level, and here is the spiritual level. So even before Christians, the pre-Christian Irish would have built walls around their sacred places. These weren't high walls that keep out invaders or anything, but they were walls that said, this is a sacred place. It's kind of a way of designating that. And so if you arrived, you would go through here, which is the gate, and this would be the inner part. This over here is the North Church. This is some housing for pilgrims and people. This is the tower.
Looks like a missile.
Tall tower. We'll see another picture of it a little later. Here is the cathedral. This is the priest's house. This is St. Kevin's Cross. And then you notice that when they have a church outside the center area, they built a little wall around that too, to show that that's also sacred, special sacred place. So this is the Church of St. Kevin. This is the Church of St. Kieran. And up here, with another wall around it, is the Church of St. Mary.
Why so many churches?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. But there they are. And this one we'll see a bit, this and the tower we'll see a bit later in the slides. So this was the inner, and then this outer is interesting that it was very self-contained. So everything would have happened here. That they're farming, they would have had a tannery, they would have had a bakery, they would have had there would have been an infirmary, there would have been shoemakers, and I don't know if they had a jail or not. They probably had other, they probably just gave them really difficult things. And there's, but so all those activities would have happened there, and over here, the monks would have lived, and it was a very self-sustaining community. And it was also a very inclusive community because most of the monks were lay people. And there would have been families here. There would have been women and children within the confines as well as the monks. So that's very much the, we'll see this stream a little later too. So that's very much the way you see it. It's very rural. It doesn't quite look like a city. Okay, now this is St. Kevin's. And now these pictures I took on my little camera, not ever expecting to show them to anybody. So you'll have to forgive the but here is St. Kevin's Church as it has been reconstructed. It was all these things have fallen down many times, and some of them have been more or less rebuilt. And so that is St. Kevin's Church. Okay, this is the tower. And again, if you saw a picture of the tower in about 1900 or so, it would have been about this tall. So it has also been reconstructed. And these were built very much for the protection. It's kind of a place to look out and also as protection, because the Vikings came along in about the 9th century and they began raiding, and many times Glendalough was destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt. So that would have been a for protection still there. Okay. All right, this is another little church here. It's called the Reefert Church. And is anybody here in O'Toole? No O'Toole. Well, this was the place where royalty was buried, and the royalty of that area were the O'Tooles. So that's known as a burial spot for the O'Toole. Okay. This is the graveyard, and this is important because the cemeteries were a very important place, because the Celts believed that death was the final healing. So that was important. And in another part of the cemetery, there are gravestones that are fairly modern. So there's still people being buried here. Okay. Now this is the lake. And if you remember our beach? Well, this lake had a beach. And it's also known in Gaelic as the Loch Na Beast. So that's the Lake of the Beast. And there is a legend about that beast, which may ring a bell, that St. Kevin took the monster to himself. fervent in prayer, his patience in the fire of God's love in him rendered the monster harmless. It's a good thing to remember when we sit by our lock and sit with the monster, isn't it? That we need to have patience, fervent prayer, and the fire of God's love, and we'll tame our monsters too. So that's the lock. So, this is just a walk. Over here is a little walk from the lake. And another. And this is one of the cool crosses that's just out in the land territory. And another. And this is the path. This path goes up to Kevin's Cell, which is one of the little place of prayer up here in the hill. Glenlock is set. It's in the Wicklow Hills, and it's set in between these lakes in between the two hills. How many of you have been to Glenlock? Okay. Does it make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. I hope I'm doing it right here. Okay, another one. And this is the stream that we saw earlier. Now, these last couple of pictures I have as my desktop on my computer because I don't know, they just take me back to that peaceful place. Yeah. And I would like to make a recommendation to all of you. I put up a website. And this is the website for Glenlock. And if you go on it, they have a slideshow of Glenlock, and it changes every month. So now they have Glenlock in the fall with the fall foliage. And it's just beautiful. And I keep it up on my bookmark bar because if I'm working hard on the computer and I just want to take kind of a break and relax, I just go to that website and it takes me back to Glenlock for maybe 3 minutes or so. So I would recommend it. And another thing I would recommendation is if you belong to Netflix, is a DVD that's called The Secret of Kells. Has anyone seen that?
Is that the animated?
It's animated.
Yeah. It was at a film festival 2 years ago. Fantastic.
Yes, it turned out. It's really an animated. It was made by French and Irish companies. We can turn the lights back on. And it's a wonderful little movie, and it's fun, and it also will bring some of this history alive. Pardon? Oh, yes.
Yeah, Martha, when you were at Glenlock, did you see the waterfall in the distance coming down from the mountain? Maybe it's only certain times of the year mm-hmm. that it's there, but it just adds to the beauty of the place.
Oh, it's wonderful. And as I said, we have gone to a number of places on this particular trip. We went to Iona, we went to but this was the place that really struck me. And you know, we don't know, because what's going to strike us is always, Lindisfarne was wonderful, Iona was wonderful, but it was Glenlock that went down here. And I sort of asked myself, what made this a thin place for me? Certainly there was the nature, the beauty of the place. And there was the stillness. Because my knees were bothering me at the time, so I didn't go hiking up the mountain with the rest of the group. I just sort of stayed down below. And I just was there by myself in the stillness. And there was something wonderful about that. And the ancient buildings, and the sense that there had been these generations and generations of pilgrims there. All this was important. But I don't know why it would have was true in other places. Something there that was special for me. And then I think it's important for us to do, I ask myself, what did I take away from this place of pilgrimage? Something inside of me, I think the biggest thing, something inside of me shifted. And I can't say what it was or why, but something changed. I could feel it changing. And I think one of the things is that somehow nature and the presence of God in nature has become much more real to me. And I think part of that began at Glendalough. There was also something that Father Michael Rogers, who was our guide through Glendalough, who also has a wonderful place that you can go and have a retreat house with. But he mentioned how it was such an example of solitude and community, and the balance between solitude and community, and how as a we need that as people, we need it as a society. And then, of course, there are the memories. And I thought, my last piece before we go to the west of Ireland, so I want to read you a little story, which many of you maybe have heard, about St. Kevin and the Blackbird. Familiar with that? At one Lenten season, St. Kevin, as was his way, fled from the company of men into a certain solitude. And in a little hut that did but keep out the sun and rain, gave himself earnestly to reading and to prayer, and his leisure to contemplation alone. As he knelt in his accustomed fashion with his hand outstretched through the window, his cell was so small that he had to put his hand out through the window. As he had his hand out through the window and lifted up to heaven, a blackbird sat on it, and busying herself as in her nest, laid in it an egg. And so moved was the saint that in all patience and gentleness he remained, neither closing nor withdrawing his hands, but until the young ones were fully hatched, he held it out unwearily, shaking it for the princess. And I think, and what a, this is to me, but what it said to me was, could we all hold our wonderful world and our nature with that same kind of love and gentleness, it would be a different world. Okay, now we're going to take a break and we're going to go over to, yeah?
I just wanted to add, how far is Switzerland from Dublin? It's really pretty close.
It's close. As a crow flies, it's just a few miles.
I'm thinking if anybody goes to Dublin, don't miss
it. Don't miss it. And I'm sure that they have tours and things. It's wonderful. And I just want to quickly introduce John Donahue. And some of you maybe have read John Donahue. He's a priest, philosopher, scholar, PhD in philosophical theology, a speaker and teacher. He was raised in the west of Ireland in the area of Connemara and County Clare, where we're going to be going in a second. And he was a native Irish speaker. And unfortunately, he was also a priest. He retired from the priestly ministry to speak and after his book on Kara came out. And this is something else I recommend anybody that hasn't read it. Unfortunately, he died in 2008, just 2 days short of his 53rd birthday. And we lost a real saint. So we're going to take a little trip with him now. We'll turn the lights off.
There was an ancient music on the earth before humans ever came here. Imagine what the first music of the wind was like when the earth was born out of nothing. Imagine the wind being released for the first time and finding itself running into silver mountains, dark mountains, skimming over boiling oceans. And if you enter into the dream that brought you here and awaken its beauty in you, then the beauty will gradually awaken all around you. I'm John O'Donoghue. I'm a writer. I live here in the west of Ireland. I love this life. you bring your body out into the landscape, you're bringing your body whole to where it belongs. Because with all due respect, human bodies weren't really made for offices, for streets and corners and tight places. In the Irish psyche, landscape is a unique presence. One of the wonderful insights of the Celtic imagination was that landscape is alive. I think that it makes a huge difference in one's life when you leave your house, whether you believe you're walking out into location, which is simply dead space that you're crossing to get to where you need to go, or whether you believe you're actually walking into a living universe. If you believe the second, then your walk becomes a different thing. What I'd like to do now is to introduce you to some of my favourite landscapes in the West of Ireland. This should be a contemplative time, the time of pilgrimage. Because a pilgrim travels differently. All within a pilgrimage there is a change of mind and a change of heart. The outer landscape becomes a metaphor for the unknown inner landscape. When the Celtic imagination raised its eye, it was searching for meaning and for patterns of belonging. It saw in the rhythm and patterns of the stars and the sun and the moon the whole order of the cosmos. One of the most famous images the ancient past of Ireland is the Pavan of Roman Dolmen. Originally it is believed that there were the graves of maybe famous chieftains and that the whole dolmen was covered in with a mound of clay. And all the time that's been taken away and now we have the just naked structure. It's an amazing thing to look in maybe 5,000-6,000 years later and see something that human hands from that vast distance of time have created. You get a sense of why this place was chosen as a holy resting site in alignment with the sun and the moon that are still rising thousands of years later. One of the lovely things about the Irish Catholic tradition is that it really traverses many archaic frontiers back along time. Often within it you have sanctuaries of spirit that belong to another time. But today when you step into them, you step out of our world and step into that world. We are here at St. Colman's Well, under Eagle's Rock in County Clare, and this is one of the most beautiful holy wells in Ireland. Celtic spirituality was essentially an outdoor spirituality. Nature was the place where the divine became visible. When Christianity came in, it actually took these ancient pagan holy wells and Christianized them. So people come here still to this day for all kinds of cures for ailments of body and ailments of mind as well. I always find that Colman's Well has something infinitely trustable in it. And if you come here with something disturbed or burdensome that is haunting your heart. You will go away lighter, more at ease, and surer of your footsteps on the earth. The old word in Gaelic for Ireland is Éireú, and that's where what Éire derives from. But Éireú was a goddess, and in that sense the land of Ireland, mythologically understood, was in the body of the goddess. And these openings in the earth were deemed to be points of special access to the energy, freshness and fluency of divine presence. The Celtic imagination had a really interesting understanding of nature. To understand your country and your landscape as part of the great body of the goddess is a huge investment of spirit in the landscape. It means that the landscape is alive, that it is sacred, and that it has an eternal kind of resonance. In our times, nature is property. We have real estate. But for the Celtic mind, nature wasn't that. Nature was divine presence. And I believe that if our spirituality is going to be really resonant and healing and sheltering, we need to go back and retrieve what our ancestors intuited about the world. And this is really, really important. Because we need to sustain ourselves and strengthen ourselves for the frontiers which we will be called to stand at yet. Modern times are really difficult. We're confronted by a roster of problems on many different frontiers. Every action has a consequence. And you can't damage things, people in war, or the earth and environmental destruction, and not have to engage with the result. I think that one of the things that will enable us to meet these is spirituality. Religion and spirituality in a really deep sense are actually always in conversation with the culture. And it's never a question of just how I feel and how's my project of self-improvement come along, but it's how we're all doing together. We're more privileged than we ever realize. And the duty of privilege is absolute integrity. From those to whom much has been given, from them is much expected. Turbulent times, you should endeavor to stay close to one simple thing in nature. And I think everyone, no matter where they live, should have some place in nature that they go to. One of the beauties of a landscape like this is the sense of stillness and silence within it. When you come into a space like that, you're actually entering into the prayer of that space. All prayer and concentration is about trying to come into presence. And I believe that landscape never leaves it. You truly are present in a landscape, you know afterwards that something has shifted within you, or some burden has fallen. My hope that in these beautiful places that we've travelled through, and some of the ideas and images that we used, that it's almost as though we were casting seed into the earth of the heart. And that someday when the bleakness of the storm comes, that we might be gently surprised that a tree has grown inside where we can shelter, find relief and renewal to continue our journey. This is a poem called Banach, which means blessing. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays and the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life.
Amen. Praise time.
Thank you, Martha.